This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. It's been nearly a month since Beyoncé dropped her album and film Lemonade, and you can still hear the buzz. It's another success for the mega pop star. Lemonade has sold close to 1 million copies, and Beyoncé continues to add dates to her world tour. The album is also generating conversations among fans, critics, and scholars for its style and messages. On the surface, it's quintessential pop, personal reflections on love and infidelity. But the personal is political in Lemonade, and that's what has so many critics talking. We'll unpack Beyoncé's messages of grief, reconciliation, and solidarity today in this month's installment of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. Joining me, as always, is Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark is a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke University, the author of a number of books, and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark. Good to have you here. Natalie is a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh and an Emmy-nominated producer and filmmaker. Natalie, welcome to you.
Good to be here, Frank.
All right, so let's start off with a simple reflection on Lemonade. What'd you think, Natalie?
Phew.
A complex reflection on
Yeah. You know, it took me watching it a few times. And you know, it took me a minute to realize that the film was separate from the album. And so the album does not play like the film. But I watched the film first, and I was just blown away, honestly. And I have to say, I have not always been a Beyoncé fan. I mean, I'm really kind of new to her stable of fans in the past 3 years since the first visual album. But this just struck me as clear evidence that this woman is evolving at, like, you know, just at the speed of light. She is growing. She is thinking. She is responding to the criticisms that she, you know, are leveled at her on a regular basis.
What grabbed you? What was the proof of that for you?
Well, I mean, certainly Formation, which was the first single that was that she released, that she dropped out of thin air right before the Super Bowl, made it clear that she was paying attention, because she addresses the fact that, you know, since Blue Ivy was born, her daughter, that, you know, people have had stuff to say about Blue Ivy's hair and have criticized Beyoncé for not doing it. People have had stuff to say about Jay-Z and how he looks and how big his nose is and all these things that are, you know, unfortunate reflections of anti-blackness in our culture and in our community. But in Lemonade, the film, you know, which includes Formation is always all the way at the end. It's just clear that, you know, Beyoncé kind of, with her first visual album, she sort of made this assertion about feminism, that she is a feminist, in ways that there was so much pushback on whether or not she is a feminist and can she call herself a feminist because of, you know, her business savvy, and clearly she knows how to make money. And so how do you separate the political statement from the, you know, the commodification of her entertainment and of her? And so I think we see that throughout, you know, but I think it's understated. I don't think that Beyoncé is trying to prove anything necessarily. There's a difference. I think that she is simply speaking and asserting her truth. And we can either go along with her or not. And that's one of the things that I really respect about her, is that in spite of all the stuff that we all have to say about her, she decides when she's going to respond. And when she responds in a way that is completely on her terms. And, you know, that doesn't kowtow to anybody else. She does it when she's ready.
Mark, what do you think?
You know, I was flying back from Rutgers when HBO ran it. And so I'm not able to watch it, but I'm watching it on social media, watching everybody go back and forth. My flight's delayed. I get home probably about 12:30 after midnight. And I sit there and I turn it on at 1 o'clock in the morning. I was just going to watch 10 or 12 minutes. And I stayed up the whole hour watching it because it was so compelling. I mean, the first aspect of it is, it's just simply beautiful.
It is beautiful.
I mean, it was hard to walk away from it for that reason alone. And then when you realize that she's kind of playing with the fiction of her own life and her life with her husband and her relationship with her mother and her father, it's just really compelling artistry. And, you know, the thing for me about what she has done very successfully, I mean, you know, Jay-Z and Beyonce obviously are very public folks, but we actually don't know much about them.
Right.
And they've done a really extraordinary job in terms of controlling the narrative. And it's almost as if they're saying, if there are going to be these rumors, well, let's actually present the story as agents in our own story, controlling that particular narrative, letting you know exactly what we want you to know. And you still don't really know anything.
That's right. That's right.
Well, that's what controlling the narrative is. But it is also interesting that this would be something you would choose to respond to. I mean, you know, another way to handle it is just not to talk about it at all. So the idea that you will fold this into your art, even if it is another form of fiction, strikes me as something interesting.
You know, there are a lot of folks that will be critical of Beyonce and saying that she's exploiting the marketplace, exploiting all these kind of narratives. You know, there are folks who have created whole discourses around what they think is her life, what they think is her husband's life, her child's life. And, you know, so she should have some right in this regard to be able to smack back, if you will,
right,
you know, by creating a narrative and exploit it any way she wants to, because it is, in fact, her own story. But that doesn't mean that it's not great art.
Well, that's right? It is a work of art, and it embraces many forms, including spoken word, features poetry from Warsan Shire. Let's play a clip from the album's, one of the first examples of spoken word in this album.
I tried to make a home out of you. But doors lead to trapdoors. A stairway leads to nothing. Unknown women wander the hallways at night. Where do you go when you go quiet? You remind me of my father, a magician. Able to exist in two places at once. In the tradition of men in my blood, you come home at 3 a.m. and lie to me. What are you hiding? The past and the future merge to meet us here. What luck. What a f***ing curse.
It's a clip from the 2016 visual album Lemonade, Beyonce. My guests are pop culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal today on Back Channel, today on The State of Things. What about the multiple forms in this album, Mark? What do you make of that?
I love the Warshawn references. It brings a level of depth to it. And one of the things that Beyonce does is she does not get a lot of credit for, generally in her career, but in particularly in terms of this album. I mean, she put a lot of people on.
Mm-hmm.
Warshawn's publisher talked about the fact that, you know, because everything was embargoed, right, before, you know, it launches, they can't talk about it. So they couldn't let Amazon, .com know.
Yeah,
it's going to be future,
yeah,
right? So they sold out immediately because, you know, they were unprepared for the kind of attention that it was going to get. I think it gives it a depth. I think it gives it a certain kind of pacing, right? It raises the bar in terms of thinking about it as an artistic piece. You know, folks are wondering, it's like, is Beyonce writing poetry?
Right,
it's
right.
It's like, you know,
right.
What's this about?
Right, and I think that, you know, the use of Warsan Shire's poetry also helps to blur this line between what is real and what is not. Because if you listen to, if you watch the film, you have no idea if Beyonce has written, you know, this poetry. I mean, when I first watched that, I was listening really intently. I was like, oh, wait, are those lyrics? Did she write that, or is that something else? And it really does add to this mystique that permeates Lemonade, because we don't know. We think we know that she's talking about her life, that she's talking about her mom's life, her dad's life, her life with Jay-Z. But then, you know, we can't be too sure. And so I think it is a stroke of creative genius that she uses this young woman's poetry, and that poetry is so universal in tone, and it pulls you in because all of us can relate to what this poetry is about. So I think it's brilliant.
Well, let's play a clip because a lot of people have weighed in on this. We're talking about critics, certainly in the Academy. It's a source of conversation, and fans, sometimes new fans. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Milton Tucker. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. My impressions with the Beyoncé's Lemonade album were that I thought it was a great album. I thought it was a great progression from what she's been doing career-wise. I really thought that the choice in musical stylings that differed from song to song was outstanding. I was very impressed with that, and I'm not typically a Beyoncé listener, but I just the style and the flow of this album really caught my attention.
A lot of people have been saying that it showed maturity. Mark, you had some thoughts about the fact that that there are so many genres embedded in this album. The fact is that R&B has taken on many forms already. It's not necessarily Beyoncé stepping out here.
You know, a lot of critics respond, you know, she's being daring, she's going multi-genre. But, you know, if you're a deep listener of R&B music is always drawing from these influences, whether we're talking about contemporary R&B music or historically. You know, I think the thing that's important, you know, when we think about, you know, Milton mentions this idea of thinking about the maturity that we get in Beyoncé. You know, we have lots, you know, she started when she was 16, 17 years old. I mean, that's when she comes into public consciousness. So, you know, so we've had the opportunity to watch her grow up. And we get to watch many artists grow up, but when they grow up, it's not usually when they're at the peak of their fame.
Yeah.
What we see at Beyoncé is her at the peak of her maturation as an artist, and at the same time, at the apex of her career as a commercial artist. We very rarely have seen that. Maybe Michael Jackson, you know, in that regard.
Well, and so often we see artists of that magnitude blow up instead of grow up, and I think it's incredible that she would grow into this and share some of that, bring on these other artists. We're talking today about Lemonade on Back Channel with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown, and that conversation will continue in a moment on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. Today, joining me on the show, Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. It's Back Channel. We're connecting culture and context. And today, talking about Beyoncé's visual album, Lemonade. And we've been talking about the aesthetics, and we certainly could talk about the artistry of that album. But let's talk about some of the themes now. Mark, how do you, again, there are these questions about whether or not, you know, we should take Beyoncé seriously, and these political themes are serious enough. How do you read them?
I think they're honest. You know, I think they speak to where she is thinking about herself as a mother, thinking of herself as a woman, both in terms of being a daughter, but also being a wife. I think she's taking those kinds of questions very serious and listening both to the critiques of folks outside of her circle, but also, you know, it strikes you as this is someone who's reading, right? You know, who's reading, trying to push some sort of depth into her life. And I think it comes out in the way that she's talking about, obviously, things like infidelity, right? Which I think we could also flip as a conversation really about betrayal, right? And then also thinking about, you know, feminism, both in terms of the user-friendly, accessible feminism that she obviously champions, but also kind of deeper implications of it, right? I'm wondering when we've seen this explosion of critique, particularly from feminist scholars and academics and critics, you know, how much of that is she going to digest and what will that look like in the future in her own art?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, being since I am a daughter and a wife, one of the things that really resonates with me about Lemonade is that Beyoncé seems to be recognizing within this album that there is a space for being a wife, there's a space for being a daughter, but at the end of the day, what is really going to sustain you as a Black woman, at least, is sisterhood and solidarity with other Black women. And I think that she really demonstrates that both visually and lyrically. And it's powerful because, you know, I mean, she, of all people, certainly experiences pushback from Black women, like serious clapback from Black women. So for her to be pushing this sort of not only feminist agenda, but this agenda that speaks very specifically to the need for our sisters, the need for solidarity, I think is, you know, it's really important not to miss.
And Mark, as you suggest, I mean, it suggests that she's reading and understands this not just strictly personally, although this seems to be a very personal album. It talks about some very personal events. She understands the historical context. I mean, let's play this clip and then come back and talk about the fact that she uses a clip from Malcolm X in this.
God complex, motivate your ass, call me Malcolm X.
The most disrespected person in America is the Black woman. The most unprotected person in America is the black woman. The most neglected person in America is the black woman.
All right, there we go. Clip from Lemonade by Beyoncé. We're talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal today on Back Channel. I mean, the clip itself is complicated. I mean, that is Malcolm X. I understood what he just said, but he's not famous for, you know, sort of treating his treatment.
And that's an interesting moment, right? And I'm going to make a reference that's only going to resonate for a few people. But, you know, that's her, you know, protecting herself against the Hoteps, right, who are going to read her as kind of feminist and anti-male. And she pulls in, right, one of the most recognizable male icons with his voice, affirming the very types of things that she's trying to affirm. It's absolutely brilliant, right, because it allows her to protect, right, you know, her, to protect herself, right, you know, from certain kinds of criticisms.
Well, it's also the rare use of something, because you can imagine, too, if you wanted to go into this this whole business of appearing to be, let's say this is just commodification, this is just a commercial ploy to make you sound smart, and you're going to go into the realm of feminism and engage in politics. What we hear often among artists is these direct assaults where they start quoting things from other people's posters, and it's pretty clear that they haven't taken it on board. It's also clear that they don't use personal. This is a very personal story about infidelity and betrayal in her life, which is ultimately not her lashing out at critics, but a very vulnerable moment when you say you're the one who got dissed. You're the one who the centerpiece of this is. I'm the one who got hurt.
Absolutely. I think I was talking to a friend yesterday about the show and Lemonade in general. And one of the things that she said to me is that, you know, it's very clear that this is honest, as Mark said earlier, that this is authentic. This is not Beyoncé trying to construct some sort of reality that we're supposed to buy into. This is her really exposing herself. But again, it is controlled because she is letting us see what she wants us to see.
Right.
You know, so it's very complicated. And that to me, just if we can just give her some credit for being smart, you know, she is, that right. takes something to be able to think about all the things that she wants to say and then create something that is so layered and complex. I mean, we have to give her credit for that.
Sure. I mean, and Bell Hooks in her criticism makes the observation that this is a commodified, that nobody gets outside, this not her words, but nobody gets outside the biosphere of capitalism. Yeah. This is a capitalist venture that will make lots of money for people, and you can't hire all those people and have them around without the promise that you're going to do
that. But we're also functioning in a very capitalist ecosystem in that regard. Right, where some of the best critique, some of the best, you know, it's not as if Black Lives Matter exists outside of the marketplace, right? You know, Twitter is a corporate entity. You know, they were able to colonize a corporate entity to do certain kinds of work, but, you know, you're still watching Twitter ads as all of this is going down. So in some ways, there's no way to escape this. And the market becomes one of the most direct places to be able to reach folks, even with political messaging at this point in time.
Okay.
I think that's just part and parcel of the moment that we're in. And we're looking at someone who is trying to balance that and do it on the highest level and still maintain a certain kind of personal connection to her fans.
Absolutely. And I think there's risk that is clear in Lemonade that, you know, Beyoncé, her fans, her fans who have been with her from the beginning of her solo career, let's say, the people that are in the Bayhive, you know, who are like her most diehard fans and the ones who went after who they thought Becky was, you know, she could have lost some of those people. She did not have to do something. I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that the risk that is inherent in Lemonade is something that to me speaks against this idea of her only being interested in some sort of commodification of her story. She is trying to share with us in a way that she hasn't shared before. And I think that, you know, that speaks volumes to where she is personally and just, you know, in her growth and development.
Well, yeah. I mean, the fact that there is a capitalist biosphere in which this exists doesn't mean that you can't be sold the rope to hang yourself with, if I make another reference. So let's listen to another listener who found a teaching moment in the album itself.
My name is Julia Cox, and I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. And I really liked Lemonade. Overall, I enjoyed it. But I think looking at it as a mother is probably how has been the most impactful for me. One thing I thought of was their daughter is in the video, and I've kind of bought into the narrative that it's about his, or a significant amount of it is about his infidelity in the relationship with Beyonce. And so how do you explain that to your daughter and come back to it? Why did you stay? All that stuff. And I kind of used it as a teaching moment with my own daughter about relationships and, self-respect, things like that.
And that's Julia Cox on Lemonade by Beyonce. We're talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal today on Back Channel.
What's it like to be Beyonce's partner? Right. When you're the king of New York in your own world,
right.
And you recognize that when you go on a red carpet with your partner, ain't nobody really checking for you.
Right.
And then she's like the hardest working person in the industry. Right. I think the conversation that, someone would have, if this is in fact true, right, that Beyonce has with Blue Ivy is that, he might not be the best husband. What we do know, and she's even affirmed that, is that he's a tremendous father. So even when we see that clip, that scene at the very end of the film, and they're playing around on the floor of the Superdome, the fact that there are so many photos of Blue Ivy, right? Well, actually, more photos of Blue Ivy in public circulation than with Beyonce. Even when the rumors hit, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, whenever it was, and at some point in the midst of all of this, she posts on Instagram that she's wearing her Jay-Z blue. And it seemed to me one of the grownest things I had ever heard from her, because essentially what she was saying, whatever the court of public opinion is about our relationship and this man, right, he still remains the father of my daughter, right? And I'm not going to allow anybody to demonize him, because when all is said and done, what Blue Ivy will know is that this man was my father.
That's right. That's right. And that's also speaks to her maturity.
Yep.
Because a lot of what I have seen on social media, that has been very critical about Beyonce staying, even Bell Hooks in her critique talks about how there's no resolution. We're not holding, men's feet to the fire about the work that they have to do, right? And I think, marriage is complicated. Sometimes you make decisions that you would not make if you were not in a situation where you are partnered and you have a child. And so, we're just so quick to rush to judgment about what people should do and what it means when they don't do what we think they should do. And, we just need a little compassion. I just think we need to be a little more generous with each other, and certainly with Beyonce, because this woman is doing all of this stuff, being the daughter, the wife, the mom, and the businesswoman in our, in a fishbowl. We're all watching this. And so I hear Julia, because as a mom and one who took my 10-year-old daughter to see Beyonce when she was here a couple of weeks ago, I told Mimi a couple of times, we're going to have to wash your ears out and we're going to have to wash your eyes out, after this. But, I think it's important for my daughter to be exposed to someone like Beyonce, because at the end of the day, it was a bonding experience for she and I. And she needs to see someone like that. I think it's important that this narrative is in our midst at this time. And I think that we need to just, again, give her credit for sharing that with us.
The moment in the film for me, after we've gotten her and Jack White and Malcolm X and this fire and brimstone moment, right? We get her in sandcastles, right? And for me, sandcastles might be one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen. Because on the one hand, we've never seen at least hip hop masculinity depicted with that kind of softness.
That's right.
When we hear these terms of redemption, I mean, he's wearing that redemption on his face.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
When you see that scene, first when you just see her hand, or his hand, right?
Stroking her, right?
Or that scene where he's literally at her feet.
Yes.
And you're like, wow, I've never seen anything like this, right? And that's when you could imagine that if this is true, and this is part of the narrative of their life, of course they're still together, right? Because there's actually a certain kind of deepness to the relationship that survives all the craziness of what it means to be Jay-Z and Beyonce.
Right.
We can't see it, but we can hear a little of Sandcastles.
We built sandcastles that washed away. I made you cry when I walked away.
Yeah, those kind of piano chords, right? They do it, but also let's talk about this. I mean, I think this gets to what Slavoj Žižek pointed out in terms of what has happened to us culturally, that culture has become politics, and our politics is now our culture. I mean, look at the theater that now passes for political discourse.
Right.
That's a show.
Yeah.
And
right.
You've got Beyonce actually using her public life. And think about it. You'd have to be Beyonce and Jay-Z in order for this story to track and print the way it has on the American public, right? Who else cares about anybody else? His relationship. And also talking about flipping what's true and what's fiction, nobody believes in Hollywood marriages and pop star marriages, right? They're all fiction and we all know it. And she's saying, oh no, we're in love and we're going to make this work. And when he comes home that way, I'm really upset and I can make him feel bad too.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that strikes me about even the song Hold Up, which is a part of the anger, you know, segment of the film, she says, you know, I'm the one who's going to hold you down. Like, you know, she still is there for him. She's still talking about how, you know, we're made for each other. We are supposed to be together.
Right.
Get it together and like fall in line, get information and let's do this thing.
And it's watching Miles ahead. Right. And Frances Davis's character saying to Miles Davis, I make your life beautiful.
Better. Yes. Yeah. Not just better.
I make your life beautiful.
That's right.
So the recognition, right? Because I think one of the things that we see here is that it's the recognition that Jay-Z as an artist not only has to see Beyonce as his peer, but someone who's really transcended him in his artistry, right?
That's right.
As an artist, he needs Beyonce in ways that he probably didn't even imagine, you know, 10 years ago when folks are running around talking about bills, bills, bills.
Well, let's talk about the fact that we're talking about this, right? I mean, which is remarkable anyway, and that the conversations have happened at so many levels. Let's listen to Dr. Yaba Blay.
My name is Dr. Yaba Blay, and I am in Durham, North Carolina. And it's been 3 weeks since Beyonce dropped Lemonade, and as expected, dozens and dozens of think pieces have been published since then. And as was the case with Formation, the online sphere has become a virtual battlefield, particularly among academics. I mean, you've got folks who support B, they love B, they see her work in line with the longer trajectory and history of Black feminist work. And then you've got folks who think that, you know, she represents hypercapitalism and neoliberalism and that there's really no place for her in the academy. And I get that everyone has an opinion, but for me at this point, especially after we did this with Formation, it's quite frankly exhausting and I'm a bit over it. So I'm wondering, as academics, what your take is on our consistent and oftentimes volatile reactions to Beyonce. Like, what is it about Beyonce that gets us in our feelings like this?
Yaba Blay wants to know.
You know, I what Yaba is saying resonates so much because, you know, I thought it was a great idea to do Lemonade 2 weeks ago. But as we approached it, I was like, Lord, have mercy.
tired of talking about it.
You know, I'm a part of a wonderful group of scholars who are women of color on Facebook. And oh my gosh, it has been just like 2 days were taken up with talking about Lemonade, bell hooks critique, whether or not Beyonce's a feminist, and just and these two sides. It truly is a battleground on Facebook, at least. You know, I think that academics are people first, and when it comes to Black women, I think a lot of the way that we respond to Beyonce that is so, the word escapes me, but you know, we feel like it's
visceral. I mean, it's
visceral.
Right there.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It is visceral because she embodies so many things that we often as women are not really comfortable addressing in our own selves, our own issues, our own baggage, our own feelings about colorism, our own feelings about the beauty standard, our own feelings about, you know, working hard and being recognized and, you know, all the things that, that you can kind of look at Beyonce and say, you know, she's an example of, she reminds me of this. She is the opposite of what I am in some instances. And so I think we just, you know, she ends up being this place where this space where so much therapeutic dialogue takes place. And it is exhausting.
Two moments about this discourse, particularly around Black feminism, are important to me. As soon as the video hits, Melissa Harris Perry from her new perch at Elle Magazine, she crowdsources a conversation that includes generation of Black feminists, including my colleague, you know, Carla Holloway, my former grad student, Treva Lindsay, all these voices weighing in on Lemonade. For me, that struck me as a really radically progressive moment because you have this text and it was able to draw on so many different folks. But then there's the density of the text. So when you see someone like Candace Benbow, you know, then curate the Lemonade syllabus where all of these Black feminist thinkers, you know, create a short little list of references, both in terms of literature and film and also in terms of music as what they drew from it. You see that this actually is a text that is incredibly productive. And then a week after this, you hear that, you know, Julie Dash's Daughters of the Dust, right, which is referenced in the film, right, is now going to be re-released to the theaters because suddenly folks who didn't think this was a film that ever could reach a commercial audience, Beyonce co-signs it, and then folks are like, oh, we got to see Daughters of the Dust right? This is what this work has done in the name of feminist discourse. Whether or not Beyonce is a feminist or not is almost irrelevant in this context.
Back Channel continues in a moment. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Nate Parker's new film, Birth of a Nation, won the Grand Jury Prize and Audience Award at this year's Sundance Festival. It's the story of the 1831 slave rebellion by Nat Turner. For more than a century and a half, the only version of this story was one constructed by slave owners. But the record shows that version is largely false. Parker's film is an attempt in some ways to reclaim the narrative. It's scheduled for release in the theaters this fall. Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal are with me on this edition of Back Channel on the State of Things. Mark, tell us a little bit about the upcoming movie, Birth of a Nation. What do you know about the film?
You know, what we love about it is that this is this really this independent Black cinema moment, right? You know, young folks who learn their craft. I mean, Nate Parker, who sat next to Denzel Washington when he was doing his directorial debut in The Great Debaters and had been in various amount of films and decided, well, this is my time to tell a story. And it's extraordinary because this is the kind of story that we can't imagine would have been told 20 years ago, couldn't have been told 50 years ago. So it speaks to where the market is. It speaks to the success of Ava DuVernay. It speaks to the success of 12 Years a Slave. And many of us are thinking, you know, perhaps we're actually going to get a slave narrative that reflects an actual slave narrative instead of kind of a Hollywood depiction,
that
makes white folks feel comfortable.
Yeah, the Black Spartacus or something.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And this almost didn't happen. I mean, you know, Nate Parker talks about how he had to kiss some toads to get the funding for this to actually take place. So it, you know, there, I'm not sure there's a marketplace for this sort of story, but he was determined that he was going to tell it. And I think it is the sort of story that if Black folks don't tell it, if we don't take a hold of our own stories, they're not going to be told. You know, we've talked about that before with Miles Ahead and even, you know, Nina Simone. And the jury's still out on whether or not that story has been told. But, you know, this is something that he took responsibility for, and he made it happen.
And that audience piece is important because, you know, we have to, particularly with our own art, get around the afterlife of the release process, right? So this might not be a film that's going to make $75 million, right? But that doesn't mean as a text it won't continue to be exist, to be able to stream, to be in classrooms.
That's right.
That there will be use to this film after, you know, the release cycle.
Right.
Here's a little bit of the trailer from Birth of a Nation.
Brethren, I pray you sing a new song. Sing praise in the assembly of the righteous. Let the saints be joyful in glory. Let the high praise of God be on the mouths of the saints and a two-edged sword in their hands to execute vengeance on the demonic nations and punishments on those peoples, to bind their kings with chains. Dishonor have all his saints. Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord. Sing to him.
clip from the trailer from the upcoming movie Birth of a Nation. My guests are pop culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. We're talking about this film today, which, Mark, as you pointed out, couldn't have been told 50 years ago. And part of the reason is because we didn't know the true story. Sharon Ewell Foster is a writer who lives in Durham. She's written a number of novels based on that rebellion and found the true story in a way that's fairly remarkable. Sharon, first of all, welcome back to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you. Very good to be here.
Tell us your story about finding the court records.
Well, I'm a novelist, as you said, and I was struggling and trying to decide if I was going to continue writing. And actually, I prayed, and what came to me the next morning, I could see this image of the Confessions of Nat Turner by William Styron. And I thought, well, as the descendant of slaves and slave owners, that I could add something to the narrative. But I thought that I was going to just follow Thomas Gray's narrative, The Confessions of Nat Turner, because that's the accepted history. But what was nagging me in the back of my head was that I should find the trial records. And even as I was thinking I should find them, I'm thinking, you're never going to find slave trial records from 1831. And I put a Google alert on my computer every time Nat Turner came up. I was reading about him, and there's a stripper named Nat Turner. So I was getting lots of stuff I didn't want. But eventually, I found where the records were. And went to the courthouse. And when I went there, I went with a lawyer friend of mine. And on the way there, I told him, you know, I'm not going to fight Thomas Gray's The Confessions of Nat Turner. I mean, who am I? And he told me, he said, well, confessions aren't worth the paper they're written on. And so I went and stood in the courthouse, and I was struck by the fact that, you know, I wouldn't have been able to stand in that courthouse a century ago. But I stood there, and I started reading the record, the handwritten record. And what I was expecting to find was, of course, that Thomas Gray was Nat Turner's attorney and that he read the confession into the record. That's not what's there at all. There is no mention of Thomas Gray in the record. Nat Turner pled innocent. And, you know, I won't go through all the details of the trial, but the trial fell apart. And so I stood there and read. There were dozens of trials related to the rebellion. And I stood there and read them all. And what I call my Kmart special blue light was blinking that goes off whenever I'm reading stuff that's inconsistent. And so what was clear to me was that people were perjuring themselves, that there was testimony that that was changing, and lots of inconsistencies. And at first I felt afraid. I mean, it just this fear washed over me. And I still try to think, why was I so afraid? And I think it's the trust that we have for what's supposed to be our historical record and our governmental records. And
but it's interesting, you chose to write a novel about this. I mean, obviously you went into this thinking you're going to write a novel, but now you've got this remarkable record. You could set the record straight with an essay, a book of nonfiction. You decided to go ahead with fiction. Why?
You know, there was a story that needed to be told. Part of it was trying to find Nat Turner because the amount that he was able to say in the record was very limited, but I could find people around him. So for me, it was like a work of art. Sometimes you define the image by defining what's around it. And actually, I felt like his mother was haunting me, like just press forward. And I thought I could tell a truer story in nonfiction than the lie that has been passing as nonfiction.
Mark, what do you make of this? Or Natalie, both, you know, the idea that we would, we were talking about this with Beyonce, that in a way it is the world of art and fiction that can most palpably and powerfully bring home the truth, the essays and the textbooks. don't have the power that, that certainly Beyonce does to generate a conversation or the this perhaps this film and novels.
Well, I just think about all that I've read in relation to Birth of a Nation's Sundance premiere. And even though in talking with Miss Ewell
Foster,
thank you, that, you know, there are some inconsistencies even in that telling of the story. The reaction, the audience reaction to this film, to these visuals, is really striking. And I think it's true that art has a way of penetrating us that words don't, that texts don't. And so, yes, I think it you know, there's power there that we can harness in the service of this truth telling.
I remember when Selma was released, and I remember reading posts and various things from my colleagues who are trained as historians, and they're raising questions about things that don't fit. And I'm sitting there saying to myself, you know, folks aren't sitting in the movie theater with a 650-page historical text.
Right.
You know, the majority of the public doesn't have access to that kind of information, nor do they want access to that kind of information. Mm-hmm. Can you fictionally depict a story and capture the truth of the story without telling the facts of the story?
Right.
Well, but also because, Sharon, as you pointed out, I mean, your reticence about even going to the courthouse, the story of a black slave trial is probably not going to be on the record. That's part of the problem of making the truth out of that part of history. That wasn't recorded.
Well, but what's phenomenal is that in the case of Nat Turner, it actually is recorded. We actually have those records. But to speak to what was said earlier, I think it's phenomenal what Nate Parker has been able to do to create a hero story out of hundreds of years of lies. That's remarkable. And to have an audience cheering for Nat Turner when he has been so demonized all these years, that's remarkable. And my hope is that on the tails of what he's done, that there can be some truth told about what happened, because it's not even just his truth. It's the truth of that community that still lives in bondage there. One of the roads in Southampton County is called Blackhead Signpost Road. That is an official road name. And that is a place where people were impaled. And so, you know, it's about liberating the narrative and liberating people.
Yeah, well, and Nate Parker was asked about the title, of course, Birth of the Nation, D.W. Griffith film, that was the calling card and recruiting film for the Ku Klux Klan, and very successful in 1916. Nate Parker chose that title for his film. Here's what he had to say about it.
Well, I just really wanted to reclaim that title. I mean, as you said, the KKK swelled to 4 million, and there's blood and death on that title. So for me, I want the birth of this nation to be a birth of a nation of people who are standing up for justice, who have a righteous disposition toward injustice, who want to heal, to look back on the things that happened in this country and the scars and wounds they created, and to say that was us. You know, that's what we did. That was a dark time in our history, but by facing it, we're going to heal, you know, together. So for me, it was about taking it, you know, repurposing it, resurfacing it. And so now, you know, D.W. Griffith, he's forever yoked and tethered to Nat Turner. He's flipping in his grave, but that's okay because we're healing right now.
That's Nate Parker talking with Bully Bush on Access Hollywood in January of this year. And I guess to your point, Mark, too, the idea is the film isn't going to talk about the inconsistencies or the discrepancies. That's going to be the straight ahead narrative. But what it's going to generate is all this conversation where Sharon and others will be called in to say, hey, what was the story, the original story, and how has it changed, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and that's what we can best hope for. I mean, we're talking about the kind of work that Beyonce does earlier around the market. You know, the hope is that the market creates a kind of ground zero for the historical narratives so folks who are, in fact, interested can go find out what the actual history is, right? In the absence of an entry point. Right. You know, that kind of work is not going to be done. And hopefully, you know, Nat Park is not just doing an entry point, but actually raising the bar a little bit, particularly in terms of the artistic representation of the story.
Yeah. And I was going to speak to representation, because part of the reason why the numbers of Ku Klux Ku Klux Klansmen swelled after Birth of a Nation is because of the way that Black people are represented in that film. Mm-hmm. And so rethinking that representation through this film, through this new Birth of a Nation, you know, spins the original one on its head. And that's what we need to do. We have to take these narratives that are off. We got to come up with a new one so that we can right the wrongs of these past inconsistencies and lies.
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead, Sharon.
Well, I absolutely agree. And I think that the hope is that people sitting in the theater will look and go, what is the truth? Mm. So that we won't continue to teach this lie in school, you know, because our children are then being fed on this lie. And when I say our children, I mean all of our children are being fed this lie and being poisoned by a lie. And so I commend him.
It's remarkable, too, because, Sharon, your research showed that actually the case was falling apart and that even the system of Southern justice, rigged as it was, couldn't get a conviction really using its own system, and it had to actually turn its own system on its head to get it done.
And that was part of what Thomas Gray's job was, creating this pamphlet, because they had one witness in court against Nat Turner, that witness who had told several times at different trials that he was an eyewitness to these enslaved people killing. And then it turned out that he didn't see anything, that he was at his still. And so as the only witness against Nat Turner, the trial started to fall apart. And then, of course, there was a congressman involved that tried to save the day. But absolutely, they didn't have the information to convict him.
And the trial itself turned a governor of Virginia into an abolitionist.
Yes. He started out himself personally against slavery, but he believed in the right of others to own slaves. He kept a journal, and in that journal, he was documenting, watching the trials and everything. And by the time the trials were over, he had committed to gradual emancipation in Virginia and fighting for it. And the only reason why he stopped was because the slave owners said they were going to secede from Virginia. And I always think what would have happened if he had been successful, that perhaps we might never have had a civil war. Perhaps the only deaths might have been those people in Southampton County.
I'm talking today with Sharon Ewell Foster, an author, also Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark's a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke. Natalie teaches film studies at St. Augustine's University. Sharon Ewell Foster is the author who has written several novels on Nat Turner's slave rebellion. Sharon, Natalie and Mark, thank you all for being on the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You can find out more about our program at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Shelton Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.